Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we continue our playoff coverage. The round ones are getting interesting. Big win for the Minnesota Timberwolves. Interesting win for the Toronto Raptors. A crucial late game win for the Atlanta Hawks. We move on down to round ones, talk about what we saw and what we may see moving forward. And then we shift to the W side. Preseason action tips off this weekend. Steve and I talk through some of the matchups and talk about what we are excited to see from each of these teams over the weekend and moving forward. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are you doing, good sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. It's that time of year. Playoffs are here, but the first round's getting real interesting. We get into the pivotal game threes. We're knocking on the door of the, oh my gosh, what's happening game fours. And it's that time of year where, you know, we talk about these series. It gets real interesting. And we're getting close to that point. Every year in the playoffs, it stops being about how good you are as a team. And it becomes about, can you solve this very specific problem, this very specific thing right now? And I am excited to talk and dig into these series with you. So let's hoop it up.
Let's hoop it up indeed. And let's start with the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Denver Nuggets. Very funny, at the beginning of the game, a graphic was shown that they had, this was going to be their 31st matchup over the last few years. It tied at 15 apiece. I was like, you know what? That's real hoop. That's what a rivalry is supposed to look like. I love that we've gotten to see this much of these two teams facing off against each other. The Minnesota Timberwolves were not very kind to the Denver Nuggets. We'll just put that frankly. A 113-96 victory for the Wolves to take a 2-1 series lead, and it was worse than that in real time. Of note, heading into that game, Aaron Gordon was downgraded to questionable and then ultimately ruled out of the basketball game, dealing with a calf injury, so we don't know what the status is for game four moving forward. But that was obviously a major blow to the Denver Nuggets on both ends of the floor. And I just came away super impressed, one, with the crowd. Fantastic atmosphere that you could feel on television. Well, so I can't imagine what it was like being there.
Well, hold on. Give respect. The Minnesota Timberwolves crowd shows out. And so those jerseys, that court, that invokes a level of nostalgia if you're of a certain age. But I think if you go back, what was it, 2024? Chris Finch was like, yeah, I like those 9:30 start times. Make sure that crowd is oiled up. They're ready to go. I was almost ready to do a bit to research if, hey, does Minnesota just do this in the regular season so they can ensure that all of their home games are on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday? Because they don't have home court advantage and they can just unleash this crowd on people. But yeah, they get it going.
They got it going indeed. And it didn't take long for the Wolves themselves to get it going. I think top of mind for me, Steve, if we're looking at the Wolves offense, they absolutely lived in the paint. In the half court, they were able to ding Denver's coverages. Whenever Nikola Jokic was in a drop, we had lanes to get to the paint, get to the basket. When Nikola Jokic was up at the level, whether that was an on-ball or off-ball action, we're able to either dribble around that or pass around that and ultimately get into the paint once again. 44 drives for the Minnesota Timberwolves in this basketball game. 1.21 points per possession on any trip featuring a Minnesota Timberwolves drive. Easily their best mark of the series. One of the best marks in a playoff game so far this year. It just looked helpless. And then you factor in the transition stuff on top of that. Denver just didn't have a shot from the beginning, it felt like. Minnesota did a really good job of dictating terms.
If we're sticking with the offense, right, I think the biggest thing is this was a team effort from the Minnesota Timberwolves as far as executing. The Denver Nuggets showcased some great defense in game one. First quarter of game two was good, and it has disappeared ever since then. So it didn't matter if Denver wanted to go zone, if Denver wanted to go man-to-man, they want to put two on the ball, they want to show help. This was not necessarily an Anthony Edwards-centric game. He played 23 minutes. You know he played 8 minutes in the second half, Nikias?
Yeah.
This was a message.
Y'all got it.
And that's where it gets interesting, because we saw Ayo Dosunmu pay off why you brought him here as far as being able to be a player who gets downhill. Him and Dante DiVincenzo in that second quarter just getting to drive and kick, playing off of each other. But him making plays, Julius Randle being able to mix in and make plays, Jaden McDaniels' effort offensively. This is a team that looked at that Jaden McDaniels quote and decided, hey, not only is he going to stand on business, we're going to drive the basketball. We're going to make consistent plays. We're going to make Denver guard us in a different way. Like, we always talk about Denver as far as pick and roll schemes and rotations and are they going to be able to protect the paint and do that. This was just, hey, pick and roll, drop, drive. We're going to make you defend in a different way. And so I think for Minnesota, the confidence level, knowing that you got this from everyone, and I'd include Rudy Gobert in that, who it would be hyperbole for me to say this was his most impactful playoff game, right? It would be a lie if I said it was his best playoff game. I feel like it was probably one of his most important playoff games. And when he hit that lefty hook, it was like, okay, Rudy, go ahead. But there felt like there was a trust between Rudy and his team in this one as far as, yeah, go ahead and get that, make that play, get that short roll, make that read. We're going to give you the ball on the roll. We're going to trust that you're going to catch it. You know, giving him the freedom to say, actually, I catch it at the top, dribble handoff, Anthony Edwards, come here. Okay, they went under. Let me quickly flip a screen. Like, there was just a chemistry that Minnesota showed offensively that was so key to this game. And that's where, if you're asking, is Denver in danger, Minnesota playing like that raises the people's eyebrow.
The people's eyebrow. That's a great shout. And I think to your point, the collective trust that they had in each other and the fact that they were able to confidently attack everything that Denver threw at them. It would be one thing, Steve, if we were heading into this podcast, it's like, okay, this was the Denver game plan. They were in drop a bunch. The Wolves made a bunch of pull-up jumpers. They lost. If it was just that, we're going to get to the Celtics-Sixers game a little bit later, but similar elements there. No, like we saw multiple coverages, multiple attempts from Denver, like a through line, at least early in these games, has been Denver being willing to switch a little bit more often than I anticipated. And Minnesota collectively just said, none of you can actually guard us. Like, I've been cackling at the Jaden McDaniels quote since it came out. But to see that play out in real time with him being a part of the reason Minnesota was able to set that tone, that game was essentially over at halftime. It speaks to the collective confidence and the collective talent that they have. Like, we are just going to win our one-on-ones, and to your chemistry piece, if we are in two-player or three-player actions, we have counters. Like, we're getting to this with good tempo on top of that. Now, I did get a little bit worried into the third quarter, early fourth quarter. I was like, hey, Minnesota, do not do the thing. Do not do the thing. As that got down to what, I think 12 points, I was like, hey, y'all have been too good tonight. Don't do this. They did ultimately slam the door. A quick shout out to Bones Highland. Timely baskets. Also made Spencer Jones do the Harlem Shake on one of those. That was kind of rude. But very impressive offensive performance for the Minnesota Timberwolves. And then we shift to the defense.
Oh, yeah! I've been waiting for this! Ooh. Let's talk about the defense. Nikias.
Oh, Denver Nuggets. Here. Go ahead.
Led the NBA in points per game this season. 122. They were the best offensive rating. I'm sure you could say best offensive rating in history at some point. This time this year, they scored 96 points. The Denver Nuggets shot 3 of 21 from the field in the first quarter. The Denver Nuggets, keep in mind, right? Nikola Jokic in the regular season averaged 10.7 assists per night. You could put that down in chalk. They had a total of 12 assists in this game. The Minnesota Timberwolves' activity defensively jumped off the page for the beginning, whether it was Rudy Gobert looking to protect the paint and try and contest Nikola Jokic with Jaden McDaniels. Him and Jamal Murray is always a fun battle, but the ball pressure, the screen navigation, Dante DiVincenzo switching, they were flying around, they were protecting the paint, they were not letting Denver get into anything. They were speeding the Denver Nuggets up. How many times have you been able to say that? They were comfortable guarding Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic's two-man game. How many times have you been able to say that? They took the flow away from the Denver Nuggets. How many times have you been able to say that? And so I want to salute Minnesota for delivering that kind of physicality, that kind of aggression, and doing that the entire game, darn near, and putting the Nuggets in a position where a lot of it is, you know, Rudy Gobert has played very well defensively. He deserves his flowers. There is an element with Nikola Jokic where, hey, he missed shots. Very funny bit where Nikola Jokic was in the first quarter of game two and said, actually, I'm not going to shoot. And then in the first quarter of game three, he said, yes, I'm absolutely shooting. And they were not falling. And so we have that fourth quarter with Jokic and Murray. We have this game with Jokic and Murray. And okay, you're kind of used to the inevitable to a degree. It's tip of the cap to them, just as far as what they produce consistently. The inevitable didn't arrive in this one. You like to throw the E word around, efficiency, when it comes to Nikola Jokic. He didn't have a lot of fun. with that. How many times have you seen Nikola Jokic shoot 26 times and make seven? And so it was just, usually it's like, okay, I'm going to set you up. I can get to my post. I can get the casual threes, pick and pop, whatever. None of it was a pitcher with no pitches. None of it was working.
No, did not have a good time. So first, to broaden things out, per Clean in the Glass, a 96.9 offensive rating for the Denver Nuggets. Second worst figure that they've had in the game this season. Only the third time all year, regular season plus playoffs, that it had an offensive rating under 100. Naturally, they have lost all three of those games. You do not do this to the Denver Nuggets offense often, and when you do, you are absolutely winning that basketball game. Matter of fact, all of those games were won by double digits. In the half court, an 87.2 offensive rating for the Denver Nuggets. I think a bottom 10 mark for them during this season. I was so impressed with what Minnesota was able to do, what Rudy Gobert was able to do against Nikola Jokic, what Jaden McDaniels and the other guards, whoever got the Jamal Murray assignment, what they were able to do, the second and third efforts within possessions when Denver was able to scramble them early, their ability to kind of course correct as the possession went on. Like one of the possessions towards the end of the first quarter, I want to say, that ends with Julius Randle just flying to Nikola Jokic, chest out, biting him up, and I think it ends up in a shot clock violation. It's like, oh, they are all the way here. Every last one of them is here right now. Now, as you mentioned, there was an element when it pertains to Jokic. He did miss some shots that he normally makes. And I did like one of the few gold stars I would give the Denver Nuggets from this basketball game. I did like them being more intentional about how they were setting up the Jokic touches as the game went on. It did turn into a lot more, let's go off, let's slice you to the block. Let's make Rudy Gobert navigate some stuff. Let's run some action with Tim Hardaway Jr. where he's setting the back screen coming up, and then we can get the play out of that. So, like, they did some good things that they can obviously build on heading into the game four. But, no, Rudy had Jokic in the box for a lot of that basketball game. Jamal Murray did not have a lot of fun in this basketball game. And when you don't have the force of Aaron Gordon that can force mismatches and put more strain on your defense, or could just save you late in clock with some random shot making, some random duck in, some transition seals and stuff like that. It's just a different element when it is Spencer Jones versus Aaron Gordon. And then naturally when Spencer Jones goes to the bench, hi Zeke Nagy, welcome back. He had some positive moments as well, but it's just like, it's a whole different thing that you have to deal with or have to try to sort through if you're the Denver Nuggets. So again, most of the praise to me is just Minnesota just taking this basketball game on both ends of the floor. So the question I will toss to you, Steve, I know we're going to do the actual panic meter in the second segment, but was this Minnesota got the better of Denver, or did Minnesota show you something that could shift the series in your mind?
Oh, you're stealing questions now, huh? Pay me my royalties. That's special. Pay me my money. This one feels more like it can't be this Denver. That's more where I'm at. I don't think this is Minnesota can replicate this easily. Not that they can't, but this is an automatic where, okay, Minnesota's defense is going to do this every single time. Minnesota's going to be able to create these look every single time. Like Anthony Edwards' patience was great. I think they got a lot of good things out of pick and roll, the drives from the guards. We talked about that. There's a lot of things that if I'm on the Denver side, okay, they've now added cards to the table. They've added some problems we got to solve. But it's more so this cannot be what this is not part of our winning formula. Our defense cannot be this. Our offense absolutely cannot be this. So it's more of a, this is the floor is in hell type of game than, okay, the whole entire series just shifted and now we're in complete, complete danger. Like if Minnesota does this again, yeah, absolutely. Like out of the park. But if I'm Denver, I'm looking and saying, okay, we absolutely did not defend at a high level. And offensively, we did not have the physicality. We did not dictate terms. We did not make shots. We could be a lot better on that and kind of change terms. So I don't think this is a series ender. It is a, hey, you might want to set an extra alarm, big dog. Are you aware of what your flight is taking off? But yeah, that's where I'm at with it. Where are you?
Okay. I think for me, I am more inclined to agree with you that I don't think there was anything that Minnesota did in that game three that the Nuggets just absolutely cannot counter at all. I think the closest thing that you get to that is the Jokic drop reps. Because I do think the Wolves over the course of this series have just found a comfort with some of the drives. And if they're able to get through that initial layer of help that Denver's been sprinkling at the nail, there is just a level of comfort at the rim that the Wolves have had that I'm just like, I don't know if can take that off the table. Better navigation is going to help, but I don't know if they can remove that comfort off the table, if that makes sense. So that's probably the closest thing thing I can get to, like, Denver, this is a problem that I foresee for the rest of the series. But I think Denver can shoot better. I think they can execute better offensively. And I think that will just neutralize a lot of what we saw. Like, the offense being that bad, it was Minnesota setting, you know, dictating turns, but it was also missing shots, and then they get to run off of that. If some of those are makes, you just get to set your half-court defense a little bit more. So, not at series shifter yet, but I am keeping a closer eye on those drop reps from Denver, because Minnesota just looks very comfortable poking at that. But let's move to the Eastern Conference, Steve. The Atlanta Hawks have once again, as the series shifted to Atlanta, have once again won a 109-108 victory over the New York Knicks. Another late game thriller with CJ McCollum once again being the hero of the basketball game. And once again, multiple big plays in the fourth quarter by Jonathan Kuminga, including the loose ball scramble versus Josh Hart to officially end that game after Jalen Brunson misses a shot. I do want to go big picture with this series, but I want to ask you, Steve, as you literally have NBA experience, I want to ask you about the final two possessions, where you get the CJ basket and then you get the Brunson miss at the end of the game. Were those two possessions in your mind just Atlanta executing slash getting stops, or was there anything you would like to have seen New York do differently on either of those possessions, from lineup construction to scheme stuff or anything of the sort?
Oh, we're going to trap door here. I see. I understand it now. I think for me, when it comes to that, for New York, they went with a all defense lineup. We said, we're not putting Jalen Brunson or Karl-Anthony Towns on the court. And they had found success with Josh Hart guarding CJ McCollum. So I'm sure if you're a New York Knicks fan, you're trying to figure out, why was Josh Hart not on CJ McCollum? Maybe why was Mitch Robinson not in the game? I totally get that. I tipped the cap to Atlanta because they had a timeout in the back pocket. So their set was just a quick hitter. It was just a quick hitter. So if you look at that, it's just Jonathan Kuminga, CJ McCollum going do-si-do. The Knicks... My biggest question was, why did you not switch everything if you had the smaller lineup out there? That to me would be the whole point. At least switch or push CJ's catch out. But I understand people being like, well, CJ has feasted against people that are smaller than him. He's gotten to his spots. He's felt good. Like, Deuce was active against them in the fourth quarter. But you didn't pay off the concept of having activity and being able to switch, deny, and put yourself out there like that. So I thought, I tipped the cap to Atlanta for, hey, go quick hitter. CJ, we're going to get you the ball on the move. Get to your spot. If you miss, we still have a timeout, so we'll foul. But if you make it, pressure's on them. So I give Atlanta and Quinn Snyder credit for literally just going with that. Like, we're not wasting any motion. Like, it's just going to be a pin down, right wing's clear. If you have space, take it. On the other side, if we're talking about the Knicks' last play, right?
Yes.
I give the credit to Onyeka Okongwu on that play. As far as his defensive effort and being able to defend the inbounder, shade to Jalen Brunson as he tried to pop, so you couldn't get a clean catch there. Now he's able to get back towards the middle of the court. And now, you know, I think it was Cat was trying to improvise like an off-ball screen. Jalen Brunson flared to that side. Onyeka Okongwu gets in the middle of the paint and then cuts off that drive, cuts off baseline. That was just good defense from Atlanta, I think. So I'm more tipping the cap to Atlanta on that than yelling at the New York Knicks. Like, this is the playoffs. Like, every team that loses is going to tell and say their coach did unbelievably dumb things. But there are two coaches. This is how it works. One coach's idea is going to prosper. One coach's idea is going to fail. And it's going to go back and forth. I mean, I think we've lost. At some point, we've lost the plot a little bit. Been some real good hoops. You got to remember, the New York Knicks are down 2-1. Because they lost two straight games by a total of 2 points.
Margins are very thin in the playoffs. Yes. And so I guess to answer my own question, then we can actually broaden this out, because this was just a fantastic back and forth all the way through. But I want to get your thoughts on that, because again, you've been in these rooms, you know what kind of game planning, what kind of logic goes into these kind of decisions. So I wanted to lean on your expertise there. I think for me, I understood the Knicks going all defense. I had a similar why not just switch everything bit. And more than anything, if this was going to be the line that you went with, I was kind of wondering, you had Mikal Bridges on Nikhil Alexander Walker to kind of kick things off. This hadn't been a great shot making series for Nikhil Alexander Walker so far. And so I figured, like, if you want to have length on CJ McCollum, have him on Jonathan Kuminga if you're planning on switching that, or just having him on CJ outright, just so you have more length. Maybe CJ scores anyway. But that was one where, again, I don't be burned at the stake or anything like that, but that was one looking back at it, I was like, huh, I wonder what went into that. But I am with you on the last one. Like that, they tried to get Jalen Brunson inbound, got denied. Onyeka Okongwu was able to get the stop. Like that just felt like good stuff from the Atlanta side. And again, Kuminga just kind of ending the game there. Just another strong second half for him in particular. I'm very proud of what the Kuminga experience has been after what the first half of game one was, where I was like, hey, what is happening on either end of the floor right now? But to the game itself, man, I have enjoyed the Jalen Brunson versus Dyson Daniels bit in this series, to where Jalen is trying to figure out what is my driving cadence against this dude? Can I get him off balance with some D-sales? Can I hit him in the chest with my shoulder and move him to get some of these short mid-range jumpers? Dyson Daniels, like, can I be physical with this dude behind half court without getting blown by or screened at half court? In the half court, can I navigate and stay attached to him without fouling? Like, that battle has just been a blast for me to watch as a basketball fan. And throughout the series so far, between Dyson Daniels and Nikhil Alexander-Walker, they have done a pretty darn good job against Jalen Brunson so far in this series. Like, I was looking this up ahead of the pod just to see, like, what do the Jalen Brunson drives look like in the series? What do the Jalen Brunson drives look like when he's being defended by either of those two guys and when he's being defended by literally anyone else? And as you would expect, there has been quite a split between it. When Jalen Brunson has been defended by Dyson Daniels or Nikhil Alexander-Walker, it's 29 drives, 0.8, a little over 0.8 points per possession on those trips. That is not going to get it done if you are the New York Knicks. Against everyone else, 26 drives, over a point per possession. Still a little bit under what you would expect for Jalen Brunson compared to what he did during the regular season. But, like, you could just kind of see, if I see Gabe, if I see Jalen Johnson on the switch, if I see literally anyone else, I can just get into my driving package. I can get into the pull-ups. I can have some fun. It's been a little bit more difficult for him to get to that consistently against those other two. And that has felt like a real battleground in the series. But again, from an entertainment standpoint, it's elite offensive player versus two very strong on-ball defenders. I've just had a lot of fun with it.
I'm going to just go with back of brain thought, because I understand the numbers there. But there has been a shift from Jalen Brunson in moments. Maybe not every single time, but he has tried to hit Dyson Daniels and said, actually, I don't care. I'm going to try and attack you and get to a bucket. And that's one of those things that lingers over the course of a series, where if he can seek out that matchup and win it in key moments, it feels different. So I understand the context. I wouldn't argue it, but you have seen a shift as far as him trying to hit him and win that matchup. I think it gets very interesting for these teams, because this is one of the first series where it feels like, yeah, there are still some game plan elements at play, but we are getting very close to who's going to get this done territory. And the back and forth becomes a little bit different. I think, like, Jonathan Kuminga was huge for Atlanta. The Knicks have a Karl Anthony Towns scenario that everyone is talking about in different ways, which is just, I feel like I'm being gaslit because I'm watching the basketball game and people are like, man, Cat should have 30 points. All the Hawks have is wings, when the entire, and I mean the entire bit with Karl Anthony Towns in the playoffs has been put a wing on him. So I think it's going to be interesting to see, when do they want to establish him? How do they want to get him rolling? Who can they poke at? I thought they did some really good things in the fourth quarter as far as, okay, Josh Hart, Deuce McBride, you run pick and roll with Karl Anthony Towns. Let's get a switch. Mm-hmm. You attack that matchup. Playing Karl Anthony Towns in the second quarter, you know, they split him and Brunson in that second quarter as far as trying to get a segment of Cat, get a segment of Brunson, and bring it back together at the end. Okay, Cat, they're switching. You get a dribble handoff and fake it and drive. You see if you can poke at those switches. So can they get a consistent form? And it's kind of shape-shifted. So where can we find him in different ways? And can we get him touches in different ways? But I think overall, can the Knicks put more things on the menu? This felt like their least intentional game offensively of the series. It didn't feel great from them in the first quarter. It felt like they were playing the Hawks game as far as getting up and down a little bit. And then the Hawks took off and the Knicks were in a dogfight. Now, credit to them for getting it back. Real, got to be tough for your Knicks fan. OG Anunoby had that, hey, I'm about to save us.
Game from OG.
And the wild part is, like, CJ made that shot, but the Knicks executed late in the game. And so they were able to kind of find a way, okay, let's get CJ in this matchup. Now let's bring Okongwu in here. Let's get a roll. Let's make a play. Let's make a read. Brunson looks to attack CJ. Okay, we found our rhythm. We're hitting this at the end of the game. We've got this one. But then Atlanta counters and wins. And so, which is more important, having the finishing move in the fourth quarter that you've helped, like you've had for most of the year, or being able to navigate throughout. And I think it's just, you've got to find a way to be more effective against when the Hawks switch, when the Hawks have a big, having more layers, adding more onto the menu. I think the subplot for me is the fact that like the Hawks have taken away the Knicks off-ball movement to a degree. So they just kind of stopped doing it for a large portion of the game. And then you're going to go pick and roll at certain times. But now, okay, you've put yourself in a box offensively to a degree. And you've got to find a way to get back out of that, like you had in game one where you had the blend of everything.
I am so glad you went there because I wanted to get into this Hawks defense and how the Knicks have at least not consistently been able to kind of flow against what the Knicks have been able to do. I mean, what the Hawks have been able to do off the ball. Because you go back to that regular season matchup that we did the live stream after on April 6th, and it was Karl-Anthony Towns being used as a hub above the break. Let's get into some splits. Are y'all switching? Cool. Are your switches clean? Cool. What is your positioning after the switch? Oh, nah. Lead pass layup. And it just felt like in that game three in particular, the Hawks did such a better job of navigating the off-ball stuff to the point where the Knicks had to flow to something else. And because there were a lot more possessions than I anticipated of the Knicks just kind of walking this up, like some of that is the Hawks' early pressure against Jalen Brunson if he's the one bringing it up the floor. But it just felt like they were later in the clock more often. And you bog down some of this stuff, and now it just becomes more of a mismatch hunting battle. Jalen Brunson can win those. You have talent to win those and get into some late shot clock making or some late clock shot making. But it wasn't the flow that you want. And then even rushing into the Karl-Anthony Towns point, through three games in this series, Steve, Karl-Anthony Towns has touched the ball 35 times inside the arc. And that is Cat receives a pass. That is Cat taking a shot. That's Cat getting an offensive rebound. Just any variation of literally touching the basketball 35 times through three games. To put that into perspective, Alperen Şengün had 35 touches inside the arc in game two against the Los Angeles Lakers. Nikola Jokic had 36 in game two against the Minnesota Timberwolves. That is 35 through three games for Cat is way too low. And I think there has to be some sort of balance to, you don't want to force feed it and further bog down your offense, but you do need to find a way to involve him a little bit more consistently, get some of those drives going, get back into some of the splits that we saw during the regular season matchups, and even in game in elements of game one, to where you don't need Jalen Brunson to carry some of the late game offense the way that he has. Like you want, in a perfect world, you want to have those two guys going, you know, flowing at the same time, and then branching off of that, maybe that's where you feel the OG impact even louder. If he's doing this on top of your two best guys doing stuff, you feel a little bit better about what Mikal Bridges can do playing off of just where it was just a very quiet game for Mikal Bridges. And quiet is being kind, to be frank. But you want to be able to feel the breadth of all this talent. And I think the Hawks deserve a lot of credit for making sure that you really couldn't get to that consistently in the game three.
The Hawks have been active. They've done what they're supposed to do defensively. And so you tip the cap to them. But that's where the lack of intentionality comes from the Knicks as far as, are you doing what you want to do? Are you poking at things? And does Cat know the assignment? You wanted Cat to play with the second unit. Did he know that he was supposed to score with that unit?
He's got oh, boy.
So you can the numbers, I understand it. I get it. But you have to know this is my time to put pressure on this team and now elevate myself into a different area where I am driving, I am posting up, I am getting the ball where I want it. If you get a switch, are you sealing? Or are you just saying, well, I'm not going to get the ball and I'm rolling to the paint? That's where the chemistry has to come in. And that's where, as a team, you got to go quicker. Like, they had some good concepts in the fourth quarter where they got Cat a switch onto like a guard. The problem is they were just so late in the clock, they couldn't get Cat the ball. That's where the Knicks had to be more intentional with their offense, which they did in game one. They have lost that over the course of the series. So they've got to look in the mirror, because you do not want to go down 3-1 to this Hawks team and figure out, okay, how can we put pressure back on Atlanta and not feel as comfortable with what they're doing defensively?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, 20 drives in the series so far for Cat, 1.2 points per possession on those. He has been elite. You got to get some more of those. To that second quarter point, one of the things I had in my notes was like, hey, the Knicks need to get Cat the ball during this stretch in the second quarter. Cat also just can't have his catches pushed out to the three-point line as consistently as I'm seeing it. Like, again, I want to give salute to Jonathan Kuminga, even Mo Gay being mixed in on some of those matchups, being we're going to be super physical with you. We're going to position our bodies in a way that these passes aren't easy. So, like, they deserve credit too. But, hey, big dog, the scheming can be better for you. You can also make life easier on everyone else if you're able to establish positioning. This isn't a new conversation we've had, but it feels more relevant now as the Hawks are leading this series right now. Also, just want to give a quick salute. Really good game for Jalen Johnson, particularly late. Second half of this game, it felt like the first time all series where, to me, it felt like, oh, there's a level of comfort with him getting downhill in the half court. That's something that we talked about on the previous pod. Like, hey, can Jalen Johnson find some areas here? It can't just be the transition stuff for him. If he's getting more comfortable and if he reaches that peak level of comfort in game four, I would not like that if I am New York Knicks, because that could complicate who I want to have on him. Circles back to the great OG Anunoby game, to where they ended up moving him all across the board defensively in that second half, in addition to his shot making being important. But yeah, and then there just isn't enough to say about CJ McCollum in this series, man. You should say more.
You need to say more based on prior podcasts.
Hey, listen. Based on prior podcast, my thing with CJ has always been: will you hold up?
Don't defend yourself. Don't defend yourself. Praise him. Give his flowers.
Literally, that's where we started. Tremendous series, tremendous late game shot making for CJ McCollum. He has been very unkind to Jalen Brunson throughout this entire series. And one of the subplots for me heading into game four and onward is just, what are the Knicks going to settle in on when CJ wants to put Brunson in action? Because I think we are past the point where Brunson just gets that matchup because CJ likes it. Is it going to be a switch? Is it going to be show and recover? Is it going to be a blend? If it is going to be a blend, when are you mixing this in? But CJ, he's just had too much fun with that matchup so far. It has been incredibly funny to watch for me. And here the Hawks are, man, up 2-1 with another home game, a chance to really put a stranglehold on this series. So curious to see how the Knicks adjust. We're going to take a break from here. And when we return, we start with the other 2-1 series because, oh boy, the Raptors aren't dead. We're going to have some fun. And then we go back to the panic meter with some of these games as we head into the weekend. Stay tuned. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. One more 2-1 series to get to before we turn to the panic meter for the other series. The Raptors and the Cavaliers had some questions, had some thoughts based on what the opening games of the series looked like. And the Toronto Raptors flipped things on its head in Game 3, a 126-104 victory in Game 3. Scottie Barnes with 33-11. RJ Barrett with 33 points in his own right. 22 points for Colin Murray-Boyles. I was both impressed and also kind of cackling at the streamlined intention of the Toronto Raptors, where the game plan offensively was very much 49% rim rate in game two. We are going to continue to get to the rim. Also, James Harden, Donovan Mitchell, we are putting y'all in action all of time. Y'all are likely going to switch. And if you don't, we get to play out a two on the ball, something that we haven't gotten consistently in this series. And if you do switch, we are pants down and we're either getting to the basket, getting to the free throw line, or forcing help, and we're able to play out of that. And for the Raptors to have that level of intention, I think it is smart. It was obviously impactful because they won the game. But the different ways that they went about this, it wasn't just high pick and roll, get a switch. Like, we saw RJ Barrett setting the pin down for Brandon Ingram on the left side of the floor to get that switch and then flow into an action from there. We saw some back screening that the Raptors were able to play out of. You still had the intention and transition to where you wanted to get downhill a bunch and really force the issue there. And so the paint mashing from the Raptors was probably my biggest story from this one, Steve. And so I'll toss it to you. Like, what kind of caught your eye in this one? Anything series shifting, in your opinion, from the Raptors? Do you think they found something, or did they just play better than the Cavs in this game three?
No, I mean, I think they found things, which was important as far as having a chance to have success in the series. Because the first two games felt like the blueprint of why they had Donovan Mitchell and James Harden. The pick and roll didn't feel great. You didn't feel great about Brandon Ingram based on your rant. It didn't feel like Scottie Barnes could be a pressure point. You had a lot of ifs out there. And so it's always, to me, okay, if you're the other team, can we put some of this back on the table? I think Toronto delivered a couple different things. Number one, it was very interesting to watch that first quarter, and it's like 10:30 in the first quarter, and Donovan Mitchell and James Harden have been in like three screens already. And it's like, okay, that's what you're doing. I thought Scottie Barnes was really intentional, brought the old school game and said, you know what, not only will I get the matchups I want, I'm backing down, I'm making sure I get a paint touch, I'm going to force you to react in a different way than you have been, as far as where I'm going to be able to, you know, try and get a matchup hypothetically, Evan Mobley's going to scram it out, and now I'm stuck with 8 seconds left trying to create on the perimeter. No, I'm going to lead the dance a little bit more in this one. interesting concepts. You know, I think Brandon Ingram really was trying to attack in that first quarter and slipped 18 times. But finally was like, okay, I draw the line at Sam Merrill. We're not going to do that. This is where I say enough. I'm not having that. But I think the other portion was there was intention, there was force. They made James Harden move. So RJ Barrett, I thought, was really good, but they got him involved in movement. They felt really comfortable with what they were doing offensively. I think the other thing that they did was putting Jakob Poeltl on Evan Mobley to start this one felt like a good way to keep him on the floor and have some impactful minutes. And he comfortable in the drop. He could be someone who could help defensively. He's still guarding a roller, but it's not the same as Jared Allen. And now if you have switches against Jared Allen, it's a more positive thing for Toronto because you have Jakob Poeltl helping on the backside. And that flows into being able to play smaller and doing more outright switching and just overall having a comfort. So for me, it's less series shifting and more like, hey, we have things we can throw at you. And it'll be interesting to see how Cleveland responds. I don't think they had the same automatic flow and force that we had seen in the first two games when it came to, okay, no matter what, we know Donovan and James Harden can kind of put pressure and open things up. And it was very funny to watch James Harden start to lull someone in, you know, and try and do through the legs, I'm about to cross you over, in the Scotiabank Arena, just booing like he's a wrestler taunting and losing, booing intensified. But I think you'll probably see a stronger effort. I'm curious to see how Cleveland wants to defend in this one because it's interesting. You had moments where they were like, hey, Dennis Schroeder, don't switch on to Scotty Barnes. You show and recover. But you also outright put Sam Merrill on Brandon Ingram. And it's like, okay, is the bit also Darko and Toronto being like, if we throw something at you, are you going to overdo this and tinker in ways that you didn't think you would?
Yeah, I guess two things to bounce off of what you said, and then we can move. Like, I do agree, like, this was Toronto executing a game plan more than Toronto has found something that Cleveland can't counter. So not super worried schematically yet, but Toronto did put a ton of pressure on that Cleveland defense in particular. 54 drives, 1.4 points per possession on those drives, which is insane. Scotty Barnes had his best driving game of the series. RJ Barrett, series high, 18 drives, nearly 1.3 points per possession on those. Like, they just did a great job of dictating terms. And you hit a little bit on the cross matching that Toronto dipped into. And we've seen seeds of this late in game one, in game two, and they really hammered it home in game three, where you just saw RJ Barrett on Jared Allen, as you already mentioned. So I'm not going to hang there too long. But layering in that level of cross matching, plus layering the level of help that the Raptors were able to do, like Donovan Mitchell, I think, had a 100% help rate on his drive, first time all series long. And you think about the collective size that Toronto had in the list, you know, in comparison to some of the smaller lineups that Cleveland was throwing out there, this can turn into more of a paint series. And then from there, the Cavaliers have a bunch of shooting talent. The Raptors shot the letter off the ball. Shout out Jamison Battle. That's the last thing I'll end on, then we can move to the next series. Jamison Battle getting minutes, scoring 14, making all of his threes, and generally just putting Cleveland in the bender with a shot making and movement. We have seen flashes of this throughout the regular season, or really just since he's been a Raptor. He just should have been in the rotation. I will plant my flag on that hill. But salute to the Toronto Raptors. We'll see what game four and the rest of the series looks like. Let's get to the panic meter, Steve. We have game threes later on today as we record on this Friday morning. We've got Lakers-Rockets as the series shifts to Houston. The Lakers have a 2-0 series lead right now. 101-94 victory in the game two. LeBron James, fantastic again. Marcus Smart made all the shots. Luke Kennard, shot making. It feels like the story of the game, aside from Kevin Durant coming back after missing game one, everybody's talking about the Laker double teams against the Houston Rockets offense. I went through, I clipped all 27 possessions in which the Lakers put two on the ball against KD or Alperen Şengün. It was 21 points on those sessions. That is not a level of efficiency that is going to get it done. But within those clips, you saw some good process from Houston. You saw some less than ideal process from Houston, some less than ideal tempo stuff. I have a lot of thoughts about where we're at with that, but that does just seem to be like the inflection point of the series. As you said at the top, you get to a certain point in the playoffs where it's less about how good you are and more about can you solve this specific problem. And so the question I want to pose to you, Steve, is with these double teams that the Lakers are sprinkling in against the Houston Rockets, against KD, against Alperen Şengün, how much of this is solvable for the Houston Rockets in terms of we can be better about what we are doing, and how much of this should just be salute the Los Angeles Lakers for what they're doing? Like, what is that split for you?
Nikias don't pay attention to what I be saying. I spend all Wednesday morning talking about these Rockets and Lakers double teams, clipping every possession I could find. Now, what I would say is everyone is talking about how the Houston Rockets have not found a counter, and they're not. How do you not beat these double teams? How do you not spet this? You should first deliver credit to the Los Angeles Lakers defense for the execution, the timing, and nailing this in the way that they have. It's not easy to consistently show that kind of level of help, to nail the timing on those double teams. And I think what you have to realize is Houston has attempted to move Kevin Durant around the board. It's not just pure pick and roll, but anytime you got a dribble handoff and they switch, a double's coming. It might come from the wing. It might come from Marcus Smart. It might come from big. There's a reason the Lakers are going switch and double when Kevin Durant and Alperen Şengün are in actions together, because they do not want Alperen Şengün to operate as a roller. And so I think the timing, the intention, and the rotation and being able to fly around has been huge for the Lakers because, one, they've been able to surprise Kevin Durant with the speed. So anytime that he feels like, okay, let me cook, or I hold it to see if you're coming, they come at the right time, they rotate to the middle, and they fly back out to the perimeter. And so for Houston, it's about, one, tapping into what we talked about with their tempo all year long, getting to your sets quicker. If you're going to create an advantage, give yourself an opportunity to start quicker in the clock so you can play out of it. And I think we saw a little bit more of that in the third quarter where they were able to get a little bit more flow. But nothing has stopped the Los Angeles Lakers from committing to this. And so it's, okay, are you going to play out of this? Are you going to drive some closeouts? Are you going to be able to get them to make multiple efforts and show a second level of help? And more importantly, on top of that, right, can we layer other things in? Can we have something else that we have going? I think you have the duo of not just what they're doing to Kevin Durant, the timing of it, and how it's impacting Houston's offense, but what they've done to Alperen Şengün, where they said, hey, we'll switch, we'll push your catches out, and then we'll show baseline help, or we'll double, and now we'll make you think, so you're not as aggressive. So we can't necessarily lean on you during certain portions of the game because you're getting the same treatment to a degree. Can we get to Amen Thompson as a screener? I thought they had a really good idea in that second half as far as Amen Thompson screening for Reed Shepard to play off what the Lakers are doing switching-wise. And then you have Alperen Şengün lifted. The problem is LeBron James on the weak side. He sniffed it out, and you didn't get what you wanted. But you've got to poke at the Lakers' defense in different ways. You've got to make them make multiple efforts. The Lakers deserve credit, and this is a J.J. Redick team that doesn't love to put two on the ball, but they will do it if we can control the rotations. And that's what we've seen so far in these first two games, especially that game two. And I think it's funny because, like, the Rockets found good sets, good actions. You know, Kevin Durant sets a pick and roll. He kind of pops to the right wing. Right wing's clear. LeBron is in the corner against Jabari, I think it was. He stays flat. Kevin Durant turns the corner, finishes. The Lakers adjust on the fly. So if we go back to last year's playoff, you remember the Lakers were willing to say, oh, this is a person in the corner, our help defense will come to the elbow. The next time they ran that set, LeBron was at the elbow. I think the other side was at the elbow. Marcus Smart was like, well, I can't double, but I can be where you drove last time. So they're going to have to find ways to poke at the Lakers defense. And so I think it's more so, can they solve it, or can they just do enough to make the Lakers be a little bit less aggressive? Can they be timing with the right decisions? Can they flow out of actions? Because you have an opportunity to get Alperen Şengün as a roller if you flow into him and make a big say, oh, that's Kevin Durant getting the ball again. Oh, I'm supposed to be up here. Now it's a pocket pass. Like, you've got to just deliver counters, but you got to play quicker.
Got you. Like, I think for me, like, I'm more so with you. Like, I think there is room for the Rockets to be a little bit better about this. But the salute to me goes to the Lakers for they've done it. They did it a bunch in game two. But it wasn't like literally every time Kevin Durant touches the ball, he is getting two. Literally every time Alperen Şengün touches the ball, he gets two. They did such a good job of mixing this in, so you didn't really know when it was coming. Now, when it did hit, there was a level of, again, we're coming with the baseline help, et cetera, so you can't get comfortable. But, like, the prioritization for the Los Angeles Lakers, the rotation point you hit was really what I wanted to hammer home. Because, like, that is the thing that stood out to me most. And when I thought about, you know, the concept of Houston facing this type of defense. Because I think, for me, my initial thought would just be, well, let's just make sure Amen Thompson is the roller or the short roll threat so he can make these decisions, since he's going to be your best decision maker. But what the Lakers have done in this series, and I think to a play late in the fourth quarter, Tari Eason ends up making a three on it, you can kind of see what the Lakers prioritize. Like, we're going to put two on the ball against Kevin Durant. And Thompson flashes to the left elbow like you want him to so he can make a decision. Luke Kennard is like, I'm going to give you a hug. If you are going to win on this possession, you are throwing this skip pass to Tari Eason. We want to take away KD, number one. We want to take away Amen Thompson, number two. And then you can do whatever you want from there. But we are doing such a good job on that particular possession, but overall in that game too. They did a great job of dictating the ball is going here. Not only are we taking it out of this guy's hands so he can't dictate terms, it has to funnel this way. And I think for the Rockets to be able to turn the tie in game three and moving forward, you're going to have to find ways to where it can't be both of those things. Like, you can't really control if the Lakers put two on the ball or not. You are going to have to find a way to at least poke at how they want to rotate. And if you can get the ball to more favorable threats for them to poke at stuff. And I think as the fourth quarter closed, the Lakers ultimately had the game in hand at that point. But you did see a little bit more intention between Houston, making sure that Amen was getting up there earlier so he could be the outlet. And they had time to get him the ball and he could make reads from there. But I've just been super impressed more than anything with how the Lakers have dictated terms with this. And the Rockets are just, they're just going to have to solve this. That is story number one for me as we head into this game three. So, Steve, what is the panic meter for Houston? Are you super concerned about this? Or can they flip this as the series is shifted home for them?
Oh, it's the seven. I mean, if you are going to allow Marcus Smart and Luke Kennard to play at this level, Austin Reeves' potential return looms. LeBron James is able to poke at matchups, also poke at Alper and Şengün in pick and roll. So your defense is taking a hit. And offensively, you don't have Şengün rolling. Kevin Durant's going to get doubled, which the funniest subplot was the first quarter where the Lakers were like, hey, Kevin Durant, not you. But every time they didn't, he scored. So
yes,
you're at about a seven as far as, okay, we have to figure this out. If we don't, this could be the thing that ends us. And so I'd say about a seven.
Okay. I am also at about a seven with this group. I was thinking eight. I was like, let's give some time. This is shifting home. Houston has been a solid home team this year. And I do think they have some built-in counters for this. I would like to see more Reed Shepard, I would say. Like, heading into that game, when I saw the box score, he only played 10 minutes, I thought this was going to be an instance of he's either taking bad shots or turning them down. The Lakers are hunting him relentlessly defensively, and they're just getting blasted. It really wasn't that. Like, it was a quieter game on both ends of the floor than I anticipated. And so if it's just quiet versus bad, like, I think you need a little bit more leeway for Reed Shepard in this one. Because I do think his shooting, the pull-up shooting, the playmaking could just be helpful for greasing the wheels. And even as you get into some of these hybrid units, let's get to Shepard plus Shepard Goon lineup. So it isn't just – it makes it a little bit more difficult for the Lakers to send that kind of aggressive help if you pair those two together in some of these hybrid units. So I'm at a seven right now. Let's shift to the Blazers and the Spurs. We got a tied series right now. The Portland Trail Blazers with a 106-103 victory in their game two. Biggest story coming out of this one, Victor Wembanyama suffers a concussion in this game. I think he traveled with Portland. Or I think he traveled to Portland. Not sure what his game status is as of recording. Just hopefully he is okay first and foremost. And then from there, like, we hope he's available for these basketball games. And so, Steve, I'll toss it to you. Like, what were some of your bigger takeaways from that game? How concerned are you, if at all, about the San Antonio Spurs in light of the Victor Wembanyama injury?
Well, I mean, I think it becomes a different series if Wemby is out. And so you can, one, salute Scoot Henderson for what he did in that game as far as the consistency that he played with offensively, the patience that he had, the control and command as far as getting to the spots he wanted to. Shot-making helps, but he showcased exactly what he could be at a high level. And did it as far as, you know what, hey, I'm gonna get to what I want to get to. I'm going to drive. I'm going to get to a pull-up. If you're playing off me, I feel confident in this shot. I'm going to reset if it's pick and roll, and I'm going to back up and get to where I want to get to. And that's important because, in theory, the Portland game plan has to be, we know what we can do defensively. And so you can talk yourself into the Portland Trail Blazers with their ability, with their personnel. If you're looking at Jrue Holiday, who can guard everyone, right? If you're looking at the activity they have, Tumani Kamara, who can fly around on and off ball, clinging in the paint, the size of Grant Thibault, can that activity specifically bother the Spurs guards as this series wears on? Becomes a back of brain thought that becomes front of brain thought, especially if Victor Wembanyama is not there. Now, if Wemby's there, it becomes a different series to a degree because you have to deal with him on both ends of the floor. And so he can cap what you do offensively, which limits the impact your defense has. And so if this is a series where Wemby is not coming back right away, and obviously his health is the priority, but now, okay, can we just bother San Antonio's guards, bother Devin Vassell, bother De'Aaron Fox, bother Stephon Castle by using a big or being able to have any of our guards kind of protect the paint and then get enough offense on the other end. I mean, going back to Portland, if it's no Wimby, with that defense and what I would assume would be a crowd that has been waiting to see playoff basketball, again, mm-hmm. now are you able to knock on the door of you're not having fun with what we can present? Or is this a temporary fix? And now Wimby comes back, we can't necessarily get the offense consistently where we need it to be. Defensively, we're doing good things, but we don't have the full mix. That's probably where I'm at. So I think the panic meter for San Antonio is probably like a 5, where, okay, we kind of need you back, big fella, and it could rise. If I'm Portland, this is the time to attack.
No, I think that's fair. Like, I think to answer my own question, I'd probably be at a 6 for San Antonio because Wimby just figuratively and literally looms so large for what they want to do on both ends of the floor. But going to the game, like, obviously you don't want to see injuries at all, so it stinks that Wimby was out. But from analyzing this series, it also stunk that he went down because I was fascinated by the early plan from the Portland Trail Blazers. When we were talking about, you know, heading into the series, it's like, hey, they haven't seen Wimby in any of these matchups. Wimby naturally walls off the rim in a way that nobody else does. Can the Blazers get to the paint? And what I was impressed with early on in that basketball game was some of the secondary drives that Portland was able to get to. Let's go empty side action. Let's draw Wimby since he's low on the floor and in the corner. Let's string him out, turn this into a late switch, and then we can attack behind him. And they were able to get to that over and over and over again in that first quarter and early in that second quarter. I was like, huh. This is kind of fascinating if they can continue to hit these notes consistently. They're able to get a Danny Avdia 3 out of it. Scoot Henderson was able to get downhill, draw some fouls early in the first quarter. I think Drew Holiday was able to do the same. It's like, okay, they have a plan here to get to the rim a little bit more. And then when Wimby goes down, again, it sucks from a basketball fan perspective, but it's like, yes, I'm keeping an eye on the drives, but this is more straightforward for me. Like, okay, can you just win these? How do Spurs want to guard? Is this just going to be drop for Luke Kennard? Is it going to be any cross-matching there, et cetera? But it's not the same effect that Victor Wembanyama is there. So if he is available heading into the weekend, I want to see if the Blazers are able to withhold, you know, keep that momentum up, if they're able to be have that be a sustainable plan, rather. And then just kind of zooming out, with Wimby or without Wimby, the paint emphasis for the Portland Trail Blazers in that game, too, out loudly, pretty clearly. So in the regular season, the Blazers had 9.1% of their touches get to the restricted area, whether that's just driving there, petering it out, getting a shot attempt, drawing a foul, whatever the case may be. That was third in the NBA. Game one, that was 7%, below their average. It was down to 5.4% when Wimby was on the floor. Game two, up to 11.5%, and it was up to 8.6%, right around their regular season average with Wimby on the floor. The fact that they were able to find their, like, legit regular season formula or close to it with Wimby on the floor, like, that screams good process to me. And naturally, if Victor Wembanyama is not available, they should be able to dictate a little bit more terms in the paint. And I wonder what that means for the series. So that's why I'm a little bit more worried about this, because as you mentioned, the Blazers do just have a level of defensive personnel that can bother what San Antonio wants to do. My only curious thought there would be, do they stick with Donovan Klingon or Stephon Castle if Wimby is not there, or do you go more traditional matchups? But it was a heck of a win for the Portland Trail Blazers. I was very impressed. Let's shift to the Eastern Conference. Another impressive win to notch the series. The Philadelphia 76ers, Steve, a 111-97 victory over the Boston Celtics. Tyrese Maxey with 29-9. Vijay Edgecombe with 30-10. Their young backcourt really showed out in this one. The question I'll pose for you, Steve, was this an element of the Sixers just playing better, or did they find something that they can consistently hit against the Celtics group as we move forward in this series? And what is your panic meter?
No, I mean, they countered. I mean, it's a fun back and forth. We talked about how the Celtics were excellent in game one on both ends of the floor defensively. They had a game plan to put the Sixers in a box. And, you know, we're in drop. We're trusting our guards to navigate screens and contest pull-ups. If you turn the corner, we're going to meet you before you get to the paint and rotate behind it. And if you do, in fact, get in the paint, we're going to collapse and you're going to deal with multiple bodies. You're not going to have fun. We're going to, you know, mix in some switches off ball. We're not going to let you have any kind of rhythm to a degree. And in game two, the Sixers were extremely decisive in countering that and understanding, okay, well, Tyrese Maxey said, I'm not going to wait. If I get the ball in transition, I'm going to get to my spot and I'm going to let it fly. If we go to pick and roll, I'm going to take this pull-up because I have the space. Let's force an over. Let's beat that screen navigation. If I know you're going to help, you know, we go empty side pick and roll, I know there's going to be nail help. Let me advance the ball. If I'm Paul George, let me get a matchup. Let me get a shooter next to me. Let me advance the ball real quick. DJ Edgecombe, let me get to my spots with this space that you gave us with this drop and get to my shot. And so that blended into the Sixers formula of, we can do enough defensively to kind of bog you down, be active, but we're now making enough shots to put pressure on you. I don't think it's a series answer, but it's a fun counter as far as, you did a great job against us in game one. We are now going to poke at that in game two. And now you have to kind of deal with, okay, how much pressure do you want to put on us? How much effort do you want to give? Are you going to make us make shots? Are you going to show the same level of help? What are you going to do? Now, the hidden elephant in the room becomes Joel Embiid. And that's where the panic meter score becomes different. Because if you're telling me the Sixers delivered the counters to a Boston team that it's a tough matchup for them in theory, because Boston takes care of the ball, protects the paint. They haven't even tapped into like pure switching, putting a wing on a big, like, and they are showing this kind of effort and protecting the paint. That's hard for this Philadelphia team to deal with. But the Sixers' entire whole thing, if Joel Embiid is able to come back, he elevates them in the half court as a pressure point. And we now have answers when he's not on the court. That's where the series could become sticky in theory. So it's more of a tip of the cap for the Sixers to take what happened in game one and flip it, more than, okay, I think they can do this four consecutive times. But if Bede's back,
it gets a little hazy if Joel Embiid gets back. And I think he was what, listed as questionable or upgraded to questionable, or upgraded to doubtful, one of the two, not just firmly out. So we may be getting closer, if not game three. If it's game four, game five, we may be getting closer to an Embiid return, and that gets interesting for me. To answer my own question, I'll probably go to a four right now. I do think, and it's probably this low because I was relatively impressed with the Philadelphia game plan in game one. I just didn't think, like, turnovers plus shot making, it just was not good enough, and Boston was able to take hold. But what the Sixers were actually trying to accomplish on both ends and some of the counters they were showcasing during that game one, I was like, I like a lot of what Nick Nurse has them doing. They just have to kind of, and so the fact that you got that shot making from Tyrese Maxey, you got the shot making from VJ Edgecombe, you got the timely shot making from Paul George, like starting the game with those cross screens from Tyrese Maxey for Paul George to get him going early, some of the shot making early in the second quarter when Maxey wasn't on the floor, some of the early shot making in the fourth quarter, like they were able to get enough from those three guys. I was more impressed with the defense than the offense, to be completely honest with you. And I think for me, I had a question for, you know, from the Philly perspective, can they ding Boston's bigs in this one? I think with the shot, pull-up shot making, they were able to do so. I was also worried on the flip side that Boston would just be able to ding Philadelphia's bigs over and over and over and over again. And I think Adam Bona, very quiet, unsung hero in this basketball game for what he was able to do in pick and roll, some of the late switches he was able to mix in. I thought he did a really good job of navigating with the way that Boston wants to stretch your defense out. And even related to that, like, I think he did a solid job. I think Andre Drummond in important moments was able to hold serve defensively. Tyrese Maxey's defensive effort in this game, I'm not going to do the nobody's talking about it thing because I don't think that's true in a literal sense, but he was very good defensively in this basketball game. Boston being like the best Spain pick and roll team in basketball, and Tyrese Maxey on multiple occasions just saying, Sam Hauser, you are not setting the screen at all, actually. Y'all have to flow into something else. And when Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown were trying to get Maxey in action, the way that he was able to compete, the way that he was able to push out some of those catches, I was just very impressed with what Tyrese Maxey looked like on the defensive end. There was just a level of collective buy-in. The weak side rotation for VJ Edgecombe in this basketball game were very strong. They have to bottle that, whether Embiid comes back or not. But if they can turn that, if they can consistently do that, my panic meter is going to continue to rise. But I'm at a four right now because I don't think it shifts what Boston wants to do in a real way. It was interesting in that fourth quarter, Boston started to creep their bigs up a little bit higher in pick and roll. But even with that, as you said, there are buttons that Boston can press. You can go Tatum on a big and just turn into switches. They still have stuff in the back pocket. So not super worried right now, but Philadelphia deserves what they were able to do. All right, we're going to stay out east. The Detroit Pistons notching the series up, getting that elusive home playoff victory. It's been a while since they had one. But a 98-83 victory against the Orlando Magic, in which one of the most dominant quarters of basketball that I've seen in a playoff setting before, to really streamline that victory for the Detroit Pistons. But, Steve, very simple question. As the series now shifts to Orlando, on one end, they got the split. On the other hand, boy, were they bogged down in that game too, and they did not have a lot of fun offensively at all. So what would be your panic meter right now for Orlando as this series shifts to the other side?
I'm at an eight based on what the Detroit Pistons did defensively and based on what they did offensively in the second half to unlock Jalen Duren. I think if you're the lower seed, you are working to put a team in a box and we need you to operate on these terms, right? We're trying to take something away from you offensively, take you out of rhythm, and then our defense has to be at a certain level. And if we get you in this battle, it becomes different. And so we saw that in the second quarter of that Rock fight where Orlando was like, we feel comfortable attacking matchups. We're not making any shots, but neither are you. We can keep you here. And so it felt like Detroit had to create separation. They immediately created separation in that third quarter. I think the biggest thing for me with Detroit was their defense was a lot better and a lot cleaner as far as just being able to nail the rotations, being able to fly around and protect the paint, and having a higher level of activity, which is important for a team that's really good at defense. They can't afford to get dinged. So Orlando has a winning formula. Did Detroit do enough to say, hey, we can operate within that and elevate? That's the biggest thing. So Detroit's going to have that active defense. And there's a couple things, right? They had to work to unlock Jalen Duren in this game. I thought Cade Cunningham set the tone in that game in pick and roll as far as playing with force and, you know, finding ways to get Jalen Duren a pocket pass early. Asar Thompson cuts for a lob. We're good to go. Being able to drive and say, Wendell Carter Jr., come with me. I can find Asar Thompson late. Like, let's just set the tone a little bit. The two things that I think are interesting is, one, Cade Cunningham cycling through matchups against Orlando becomes interesting as far as I think I can attack Paolo. I think I can attack Desmond Bane. I think I can attack Jalen Suggs. If he has the blend of I'm hunting these matchups and I can get to my spot and score and we can sustain off that for a little bit, that's key. But don't forget in that third quarter, right? Jalen Duren's been an adventure because Orlando has mixed in switches and they've tried to take his roles away. He wasn't winning drives against Wendell Carter Jr. Looked like he was overthinking at times. In that third quarter, I think you credit Jalen Duren for what he did as far as working to position himself to make sure he could roll. And so he worked to make sure he was in a spot to flip the angle of his screen so he could get under the defense. Because normally if you set a screen, the defense is going to position themselves to where, okay, I can get under you, I can switch. He got a touch, did not allow that switch. So even if it was technically a switch, his man was behind him. He was able to roll. And Detroit went to these high pick and rolls where he went with a flat angle screen, a step up, where A, K can attack either way, but I am ensuring that you cannot switch and get under me. I can get to a roll. And then as that third quarter went on, Detroit was casually able to mix more rolls in. That's important because whatever questions you want to have about Detroit shooting creation-wise, it is amplified if a team switches. If they have a role element where you have to help, they can unlock and play the kind of game they want to. So that's why I'm at an eight. If Detroit has figured this out to where we can now get Jalen Duren going, we have Cade Cunningham playing at this level, we have our defense, you have to deal with us in a different way than what you would want to win how you did in game one.
No, I think that's fair. I think that's really good stuff on the Jalen Duren screening portion. So I want to give you the salute on that one in particular. I was at, I think, what, a four on the Detroit scale after the game one loss because I felt like there are some screw tightening that they could do and some things they can shift to. And then they have this game. Like, I didn't anticipate, again, just it 30-3.25 at a certain point. Like, that, you can't bank on that. But I did expect Detroit to bounce back. And I'm kind of at a seven with Orlando because it was a very loud example of this is how teams want to treat you in the half court. And you still haven't proven that you can consistently generate good stuff. There have been pockets, there have been moments, but you haven't been able to consistently take that off the table. In game one, Steve, Detroit switched about 10% of the pick and rolls that Orlando ran. In game two, they switched 52% of them. And the Orlando Magic half-court offense did not have a good time. 98.9 offensive rating in game one in the half court. That was in the 60s in game two. Like, that is untenable for me. And the fact that Detroit was able to put Orlando in that sort of a box is concerning to me. Because even in the game one loss for Detroit, and we talked about this, Detroit was still able to get in transition at a high clip. Like, they were still able to get stops and get out and run. They had to execute better in the half court, and so you had to see what that was going to look like. And another point that I made was like, hey, Cade, as the game went on, second quarter onward, he did feel comfortable with how he wanted to attack. And that bleeds into this game too, where, as you mentioned, I can just go through whatever coverage you toss out, I have an answer. And whatever matchup you give me, we have an answer. And if Cade is that comfortable and Detroit's defense is back, Orlando, we're back to the regular season questions with Orlando. Like, hey, what exactly do you do to create consistent advantages? Because Paolo can win a one-on-one, Bane can win a one-on-one, Franz can win a one-on-one. The latter two just largely did not in the game two, and I expect them to be better in game three moving forward. But how can you generate, how can you move defenses consistently? I'm right back there based on what Detroit was able to do. For them to just turn that into, we're switching over half of your stuff and you just got to win. I would like to feel better about Orlando being able to take that off the table. So we will see what it looks like. Again, you zoom out. They did get the split. They have home court advantage now. But Detroit was really able to dictate terms in a way where I don't feel great about it heading into the weekend. Final game, Steve. We have the Thunder. We have the Suns. Another win for the Oklahoma City Thunder, 120-107. But Jalen Williams, fast break layup, about 6:30 mark in the third quarter, pulls up, grabs at the hamstring. He's now been ruled out with a hamstring injury, going to be checked on weekly. And so I would imagine his status in this season is in question for sure, especially if it doesn't extend. And so kind of a double panic meter, Steve. First, on the OKC side, how worried are you that Jalen Williams is out, whether in regard to this series or just moving forward if they do advance? Are you what is your level of concern with OKC with Jalen Williams out again?
Zero.
Okay.
And Jalen Williams is an excellent player, and we know what he does to elevate Oklahoma City. So this is not a Jalen Williams comment. And the shame of it was Jalen Williams was playing with so much force in that game prior to the injury. The reason why I say zero is because that's the reason they exercised extreme caution when he was hurt earlier in the year, because of who they are as a team. So I'm not necessarily worried about Oklahoma City having to shapeshift or change, because they've already done it and they've proven it. They won 64 games. And how many of those did Jalen Williams play? Again, he elevates them to where this is incredibly difficult to deal with. But if you're talking about OKC without Jalen Williams, the defense is not going to change. We have lineup versatility. We can get to what we want to do on both ends of the floor. You still have to deal with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. We can get the two-man game. Like, we can get to what we want to get to. And so that's where the proof of the pudding is. So, yeah. Well, they're going to need him to win a championship. But as far as this series go, Phoenix, have you figured out our defense? Are you ready to deal with this activity and physicality and the nuance we show in pick and roll? How many possessions have we seen where Phoenix tries to run a set, they get to an action, 12, 14 on the clock, Dylan Brooks, Devin Booker, Jalen Green has the ball, and Oklahoma City's defense has reset? They haven't poked the holes they need to fully be the annoying team against this Oklahoma City Thunder team. Not to say they can't, and I would imagine they get one in the Valley because of how that crowd treats them, because of the effort they give. But at the same time, overall series-wise, Oklahoma City has too many defensive cards, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has too many offensive cards as far as, cool, you want to show early help? I'm going to find my counters. I'm going to make these shots. I'm going to make these drives, make these plays. So zero for me for OKC.
Okay. As you split it up, I was like, okay. I think for this series, I am with you. I'm at a zero. Like, I think the Thunder should be able to win this series. Even if it's not a sweep, they should be able to win this series with Jalen Williams out. I agree with you that they have not been able to poke at OKC enough. I do want to commend the efforts that Phoenix has made in some of the subtle some of the spacing tweaks that they've made on offense, some of the way they've dialed back some of the help in game two compared to game one, so we don't give some of the automatic playmaking reads that Shai had in game one. There has been some legitimate good playoff game plan stuff through these first two games, but it is kind of a talent play. Zooming all the way out for the postseason, I'm probably at a five. Because this is it'd be one thing if just like twisted ankle, like obviously that can linger. But hamstrings, I'm always kind of scared of. Because even if you feel good, you are one wrong turn away from not feeling good anymore. And I do think, as you mentioned, for OKC to win a championship, I do think they're going to need Jalen Williams. Like, one of my favorite parts of this series, as you zoom out for overall takeaways, is that Shai's seen different looks. We've had the bad shooting game from Shai. We've also had the great shooting game. The fact that Jalen Williams has looked increasingly more comfortable and more like NBA version of himself that we saw last year, that was a positive to me. And like Chet against all the guys has been generally solid through two games in the series as well. Like, those guys being able to produce to that degree is where I was intrigued. If Jalen Williams is out and we head into a second round series against either the Lakers or the Rockets or a Western Conference Finals, where you were seeing maybe the Nuggets, maybe the Wolves, maybe the Spurs, we'll see. All of those teams can tap into playoff game plans defensively. They can put strong wings on Chet Holmgren at this point and further complicate OKC's half-court offense. And so that's where I'm like, nah, they kind of need Jalen Williams to be healthy once you get later in this. I'd say probably like a five overall, but within this series, a zero, maybe a one, depending on any kind of lineup tweaks that we see for Phoenix moving forward. But that's where I'm at on that front. And we're going to take a break right here. And when we return, we shift to the W side. We have preseason action on the way this weekend. Steve and I are going to look at some of these matchups and just talk through what we're excited to see and what we're going to be monitoring as preseason action starts. Stay tuned. We are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. As we shift to the W side, Steve, we have preseason action on the way. Six games this weekend, seven games if you add the game in on Monday. So seven before our next podcast, at the very least. We got some fun matchups here. And so this is less going to be let's preview these preseason matchups, and more so, let's use these matchups as a vehicle to explore what we're excited about moving forward, what we're going to be looking at with these teams in preseason play. So top of mind as we kick things off on Saturday, we have the Indiana Fever. Caitlin Clark is back. Aaliyah Boston is back and very well paid. Kelsey Mitchell back, very well paid. Some fun free agency additions. And we have the New York Liberty as well. The core is back. Satu Sabally is here. The buzz out of training camp in New York is that the offense has been simplified a little bit. It's going to look a little different, going to feel different. The players seem to be really into the early implementation. So heading into this matchup, I guess starting with the Fever, as Caitlin Clark talked a little bit about this during media day, just being moved off the ball a little bit more. In the half court in particular, I want to see what the off-ball usage and what that blend is going to look like for her in this matchup and just in general in preseason play. How much of this going to be Aaliyah Boston initiating at the top of the key? How much of this is going to be Kelsey Mitchell just initiating actions as they drafted Raven Johnson? Like, how often are we going to see Raven plus Caitlin together? Is that going to be Raven kind of spearheading things as the initiator so you can lean more into the pin downs and staggers and things like that for Caitlin Clark? I want to see what that blend is going to look like. How many threes is Aaliyah Boston taking is always going to be top of mind when you have a big that skilled and someone that is experimenting with that shot. And then finally, I'm keeping an eye on the Indiana Fever's defensive structure. So under Stephanie White last year, you saw them ramp up how often they were doing full court pressure or just back court pressure. You saw Aaliyah Boston at the level of pick and rolls a lot more often. Obviously with Natasha Howard beside her, she was doing that as well. With the personnel, are you sticking with that? Is it still going to be a high pressure system? Are you dialing that back at all? Is it going to be more drop for Aaliyah? So I just want to see what the attempts are defensively. But that's where I start with the Indiana Fever. What are you excited to see with this Fever team before we shift to the Liberty?
Well, I mean, I think that's going to be a common theme over the course of this segment is what's the attempt? What are you trying to do? What have you worked on? What do you want to see prosper as we get very close to this W season tipping off? And so I think when the conversation is Caitlin Clark maybe not having it as much, I think that's more so, hey, can I not bring the ball up the court every single time and deal with full court pressure? And so can we get into different actions? Does that unlock more of Caitlin Clark off ball, more dribble handoffs, or more, hey, Caitlin Clark is going to wait, get the ball, operate in pick and roll? Caitlin Clark is the engine, is going to be able to play off of her, and Caitlin Clark is dangerous in transition. We know that. And so is it more so, are we getting to more of a flow as opposed to Caitlin Clark has to deal with pressure and now we have to set up? Does this enhance their flow? And so we know with Stephanie White, traditionally, she's been really good at finding a way to have a team get to different types of movement. We saw that last year in the playoffs as they didn't have all the people they had, but hey, we're going to get to different things because we have to find a way to grind through and get offense. And so the blend is important for me when it comes to this Indiana Fever team. You know, we've seen the high end of what Caitlin Clark and Kelsey Mitchell can do together. We've seen the growth from Aaliyah Boston. What do the lineups look like? How are we optimizing or using the optionality of having Lexi Hull, having Sophie Cunningham, having Raven Johnson, having Shatora Walker-Kimbrough, having Ty Harris? Like, how many different combinations can we put together where we feel like we have a continuous cycle of what we want to do on both ends of the floor? Can we get to different things? Who plays with who? How often do we want to go small? Do we mix up our fives? Like, I think there's just a lot of question marks as far as the attempt from the Fever, but I want to see what it looks like because I think they have a lot of potential to build on what they did last year with players that fit their identity.
Yeah, I think just to quickly put a number on the Caitlin Clark thing, received 26.6 off-ball screens per 100 possessions in her rookie year. That was down to around 19 per 100 possessions last year. And so let's see if she is off the ball more, just kicking off possessions. I would imagine that number goes up, so that part should be fun. And the other thing that I'll add on the Raven Johnson front, just excited to see her in this context. But let's see how she's guarded. Is she seeing switches? Is she seeing unders? How aggressive is she going to be against some of those softer coverages? Because I think that would shed a light into how often you want to get into like the Raven plus Caitlin lineups and how often you want to downsize and things like that. As we shift to the Liberty side, Steve, I already kind of teased where my intrigue starts. It's with this New York Liberty offense. Like, obviously, when you are implementing someone like Satu Sabally into a team that has this amount of high-end talent, how you slot her in, what her usage blend is going to be top of mind. But structurally, seeing so many of our New York Liberty media pals on Twitter and elsewhere, Chris DeMarco saying, hey, we're simplifying this. We want our players to be able to play without thinking as much as they were at times last year. Sabrina Ionescu seems pleased. Breanna Stewart seems pleased. Jonquel Jones seems pleased. I just want to see, like, is the spacing being tweaked in any real way? There was a lot of five out from them last year, and that led to some positives in terms of driving lanes, but also some downstream effects that maybe they weren't anticipating as much last year. The offense in general, I think, is kind of where I start with the New York Liberty in this matchup and just heading into the preseason. But what are you excited to see with this Liberty group?
Well, I mean, I think for me with New York, it's just about the flow. They have so many pressure points, they can hit you in different ways. And so how do we elevate our spacing and how do we make quicker decisions to make you, as a defense, have to make decisions, and we can leverage our talent to open things up. And so I think you can use so many of their players, different types of actions. Yeah, you can make it simple. Stewie can come off ball, on ball. Jonquel can space and be in the post. Sabrina can be on ball, off ball. You have so much talent that, yeah, let's just play out of it. And I think what you saw kind of at the start of last year was more read and react, more trust in the spacing, more drive and kick, more let's play. Do they just tap into that and fully embrace that? And so the main thing is just how aggressive and assertive is the Liberty offense going to be to start the season? And then what does it look like with a player like Satu Sabally, who can do so many different things eventually? You know what I mean? Like, that's the concept of how do you merge all this talent together? How do you get everything to kind of operate to where you feel all of our players that we have, and we can balance that out with all the lineups we have. I'm more interested in the defense. Okay. Offense, fine, cool. The Liberty roster is set to be a high-level defensive team in theory because of the amount of good defenders they have. And so what lineup combinations do we see? How do they insulate different players? And what type of attempts do they try and make on that end of the floor? Is it going to be high activity or relying on rotations? Do we feel comfortable with what we've built? That is where it gets interesting, because we can talk about the offensive improvements, but there was a defensive base that grew over the years with the Liberty. Is that going to stay the same? Is that going to be enhanced, or will that take a step backwards?
Okay, I think that's fair. I think within that, the return of Benaja Laney Hamilton is going to be a lot of fun. See how she's deployed defensively, which matchup she takes on, et cetera. And then just quickly, Leonie Feavish. With more talent around her, maybe she isn't as overtasked as she was at points during last season. Do we just get the all-defense campaign? But in general, how aggressive is she going to be offensively? Because I think there is just room for her to find her spots more often within the flow of New York's offense. So that's going to be interesting to me. Let's move to the Los Angeles Sparks as they're taking on Team Nigeria this weekend. So for the Los Angeles Sparks, basic question for me is, I think I'm going to be keeping an eye on the lineups. Like, there's only so much you can glean from preseason play because you're trying to see who else is making the roster and things like that. But who's going to be the fifth? Like, how often do we see Ray Burrell kind of completing these starting lineups? Do we at all see De'Erica Hamby, Nneka Ogumbike, and Cam Brink on the floor at the same time? Will we see that at all? How often will we see Erica Willer plus Kelsey Plum plus Ariel Atkins, and then two of Nneka, De'Erica, Cam Brink? Like, the line of constructions that the Sparks can tap into really excite me. And then beyond that, what is the Cam Brink offensive aggression going to look like? How often is she sprinkling in threes? Like, this is something that I asked her about heading into the Unrivaled season. And so sprinkled in a few, but it wasn't like a high volume deal. What is her usage going to be there? And Tanaya Latson, I just love this landing spot for her. And so I am just excited to watch her play basketball and see her in this context and see what these drives could hit for in this LA system. So, like, that's where I start with the Sparks. Steve, what are you looking forward to this weekend and moving forward with the Los Angeles Sparks?
What's the combinations? What are we looking to put together? How are we separating our talent and balancing throughout the game? Because you add Nneka and Ogumbike, obviously it makes your team better, but Nneka can anchor a lineup. De'Erica Hamby can anchor a lineup. Cam Brink can anchor you defensively. So what are the combinations to elevate? And then, okay, Kelsey Plum. Is Kelsey Plum's been very good? What's the role for Ariel Atkins? What's the usage for Ariel Atkins? How are we fitting that within the flow, what we want to do offensively? And then what can we do defensively to kind of maintain throughout? And so how much of Nneka being there is also, hey, we can make sure we have defense on the floor at all times. And so it's more the theory of, okay, we put this talent together to elevate what we built on last year. Which part gets elevated first? Is it the offense, to where you have to deal with us in a different way that you didn't anticipate? Because we have guards who can attack. We have posts who can play. We can put you in different positions. We can attack matchups. Or defensively, hey, we're just a lot stronger on this end and more consistent on top of what we've done offensively. So it's more so, okay, what is the idea here as far as what you put together?
Okay. Now, with the understanding that we are just going to see a lot of different lineups over the weekend and just in preseason play in general, what would be your starting five for the Los Angeles Sparks if you had to make that decision?
I mean, if I had to make the decision, I'd probably go De'Erica Nneka, Kelsey Plum, Errol Atkins, Ray Burrell.
Okay. And then Cam Brink as super sub, and you can obviously flow into stuff there. Okay, I think that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I was just curious, like, would you go that route? Would you go smaller with Erica Will approach Kelsey Plum? I don't think you're going to start all three of the bigs together, though I would probably do that on 2K and have a whole lot of fun with it. But just wanted to see what your thoughts were on that front. We then move to this Chicago Sky-Phoenix Mercury matchup, where the Sky looked very different. Satu Sabli's in New York now, so naturally the Mercury looked very different. Starting with Chicago, this is going to be a very basic point, but I just want to see what this looks like because the personnel is so different on both ends of the floor. And even looking back to what the Sky did last year under Tyler Marsh, there were a lot of attempts to where higher big initiation. We let Angel bring the ball up the floor more often, let her initiate stuff. We had different guards initiating actions with different trigger points. Defensively, we started the year with Camila Cardoso at the level and sprinkling in some late switches. We didn't dial that back as the year went on. And so we have a head coach that is willing to do different things. And now he has a roster full of players that can do a lot of different things. And so on a very basic foundational level, I want to see what the attempts are. What is this starting lineup going to be? How are you getting Rekia Jackson her touches? Where do you want Camila Cardoso to get the ball? How often is Skylar Diggins on the ball versus off the ball? How does Gabriella Jaquez slot into this as a threat? Like, the gears are just turning for me with what the Sky are going to look like. Independent of how good the attempts are going to be, we'll have time to judge that. I just want to see what the initial attempts are with this Sky group.
You snuck Gab in there. I understand it now. I think for me, the anticipation with the Chicago Sky is just a cleaner process. With what Tyler Marsh has wanted to do offensively and defensively, there's probably more avenues to do it with this roster. And so there may be question marks, but okay, if we can get Camila Cardoso to work, to seal, and to roll, we don't have the same element of, okay, we have to manipulate and manufacture two bigs or, you know, going second side. We can keep some of those elements to where we have Camila, we have Isaiah Stevens, and okay, we know we can get to the second side, but we don't have to necessarily, you need to start here, maybe flash here, and if we get to a second side action, we're fine. So is there more impact for Cardoso? Rekia Jackson, is there more room for her to initiate, be involved, drive, get post seals, tack matchups? Is there more space to have different combination of bigs that work better for what Tyler Marsh has wanted to do? And then the guard play, how does that stand out? How does that operate as far as having a player the level of Skylar Diggins and having the freedom that she will have and the bigs she can play with? What does that open up? You know, obviously you have Sloot, you have J.C. Sheldon, you have, you know, Gabriella Jaquez. You have different players who can operate in different roles. So it's more so, is this just a better attempt at what we tried to do last year for the Chicago Sky? And does that make things easier?
Okay. No, I think that's fair. And I'll just very quickly say before we move to the Mercury section, as all W teams generally do during training camp, like you'll just have these like minute long videos of we're miking up a player, seeing what they're up to during this particular day of practice. The one with Rekia Jackson for the Chicago Sky had me laughing out loud for like 10 straight minutes. Like just a bubbly personality. Like I'm just happy that she is in a different context. That just had me cackling, but excited to see what the attempt's going to look like for Chicago. Now for Phoenix, that was just in the WNBA Finals. The Aces ultimately able to win that one, but the roster is going to look different. Like one veteran sounding and what feels like 45 different training camp invites. In all seriousness, 17 players on training camp deals, 11 technical rookies here. So like on a basic level, it's like who is going to make the roster? Who's going to emerge among this group to finalize things? Beyond that, though, I'm curious to see, like, if anything structurally shifts for the Phoenix Mercury, like how they want to initiate that offense. Does that change at all based on who they have in the room defensively, as they were a very high level, like full court pressure team as well? We can mix in some aggression, very low switch rate team. Like, do they alter any of that? Those are kind of the things that I'm looking for when it comes to the Mercury. Like, I am very much of the mind this is going to be a good team regardless. When you have Alyssa Thomas, we have Kalia Copper, you are going to win regular season games. But I do want to see if there are going to be any sort of tweaking from the Phoenix Mercury, or if it's just going to be, we are just going to execute what we do.
You cannot trick me again, Phoenix. I did this last year. I was trying to figure out what you are, who you are, who you're trying to play. You look different in the preseason. You got to the regular season, you got to cook it. Can't trick me again. Okay. I'm just going to see who you value, what they can do, because I know the system. I know what Alyssa Thomas can do. I know what Kyle can do. I know what you want to do defensively. Who are you trying to add to this program? Because last year, you just hit everyone in the preseason and came in the regular season with, ha-ha, this is our team. So, no, I'm just going to sit back with no judgment on the Phoenix Mercury, and I'm going to watch. That's my plan.
Okay, fair enough. They did add a lot of, if you're looking at some of the names in terms of training camp contributors being added to the room, so obviously they want to emphasize more of that around Alyssa Thomas, but yeah, like I just don't really have doubts on that front. Last couple of games here, the Minnesota Lynx taking on the Washington Mystics on Saturday. The Lynx also taking on the Nigeria national team on Monday. Steve, what are you excited to see from the Minnesota Lynx this preseason?
What's it look like? You've had to evolve. No Nafisa Collier, you lost a lot of chunks of the roster that you had. The continuity is not there. So are we a team that has built something and we can plug pieces in and evolve with it and build on that? Are we sharing something different because we have different personnel? That's just more so. I just want to see what Cheryl Reeve is going to try. That's the biggest thing for me. When it comes to the Mystics, what's the youth look like? You're going to talk about how they don't have anyone who can shoot the basketball. What's it look like? How are you going to deal with some of the bigs and Sonya Citron? What's the growth like? What is the Mystics attempt to build on, hey, we're kind of annoying, we're young, we're going to be aggressive and active. Is this a team that's going to be good because they don't know any better at some point? That's where it gets interesting, because I think them and the Sun are fun teams in this W context where, hey, teams aren't necessarily built this way to a degree, but what if we were? And so we're going to give you all sorts of buckets and defend and make TikToks after. Like, they're a good team. They got a lot of talent.
I will say you certainly feel the youth of this Washington Mystics team with how they interact with each other off the floor. Very fun team. So it's going to be fun on that part. I think to the Minnesota, gosh darn it, when it comes to the Minnesota Lynx, I'm with you. Like, how quickly do the veteran forwards slot in? I'm excited for Natasha Howard back in this context. I'm excited for what Nia Coffey can do. Hearing Cheryl Reed talk about Nia Coffey and some of her defensive, her reputation and things like that. I'm like, ooh, do we get any sort of unleashed Nia Coffey in this, for whatever that means? I'm not expecting her to average 20, of course, but do we get a more streamlined role for her? I'm excited about that portion. And like, zooming out, it's kind of just the rookies for me with Minnesota. Olivia Miles is the obvious headliner. Like, how much on-ball responsibility does she get playing off of or around Courtney Williams, Kayla McBride, also in the wing room? But like, do she just get the keys and she's coming out the bench? Is it going to be a quick hook and Cheryl Reeve is teaching lessons? Does she get freedom? I want to see what that relationship building early on is going to look like. And then, hey, man, Emma Chakova, if we see her, Alyshka Hamzova, if we see her, like, what does that look like? Because I think they can slide into what the Minnesota Lynx do on both ends of the floor. So for whatever, however often we see them, either Saturday or Monday, I'm excited to see what those attempts are going to look like. And with the Washington Mystics, like, yes, I do have spacing concerns. Very interesting for the YouTube folks as they were showing Mystics highlights. Like, you saw Stephanie Dawson making high post passes. Like, at least you could mix in a stretch big to kind of open things up. And they just largely don't really have that on the roster right now either. So, like, even with that, in all seriousness, though, Steve, like, the Mystics impressed me early on last year because I had similar shooting / spacing concerns, but they were mixing in these, like, inside the arc pick and rolls. Like, they were able to carve out spacing in a different way to add into attacks, and they were a very good cutting and off-ball screening team as well. So, like, they found avenues to work around it. I do think the contest is going to be even tighter with this current personnel, but they obviously deserve the opportunity to prove me wrong on that front, to see that this can be viable longer term. And so seeing this young talent blend in together, how Lauren Betts is going to be used on both ends of the floor, like, that's going to be exciting for me. I just want to see the young talent in general. But I am absolutely keeping a closer eye on the spacing tenets of this group. We shift to the Seattle Storm and the Golden State Valkyries now. For Seattle, we talked about them a little bit on Tuesday, so I'm not going to hang there too long. Similar bit. What is the attempt going to be under Sonya Rahman? Like, there seems to be a lot of healthy buzz about what this offense looks like and how much freedom players are going to have. I'm curious to see what that means for Don Belonga in particular. Is she bringing the ball up at the defensive rebounds now? Is she initiating more pick and rolls? What are the post touches going to look like? Because you saw real growth during the unrivaled season with her being able to establish and maintain positioning as she was getting into some of these seals. And so, like, what offensive freedom do we see? And then naturally the rookies. Like, I don't know if we see our fam during the season, I believe. But eventually, I want to see how she factors in on both ends. And Flaje Johnson, who, again, just has not stopped smiling since she's been in Seattle. How is the usage going to look for her on both ends of the floor? How is she deployed defensively? How much on-ball usage does she get versus making sure she's attacking with an advantage with off-ball screens and things like that. But is this going to be pro-style offense for Seattle? Like, I'm curious to see what those attempts are going to be. Where are you at with Seattle?
I'll go very quickly. What's the base? What's it look like? Yeah. Let's remove the mysterious aura. Let's see what you want to try and attempt to do with this roster that's younger, and let's see if you build on that. Kind of like Golden State last year. To Golden State, I just want to watch the defense. I want to see if they built on becoming more annoying defensively with added personnel. And so for me, if Golden State is going to elevate their defense but also get better offensively, there are conversations to be had about what Golden State could do this year as far as elevating what they did last year. But I want to see what their defensive principles are, if they're nailing those notes early, and what that could mean for their start of the season.
Oh, man. They're very excited to see this Golden State defense, of course. The personnel is insane. It's another year system now, and you're adding Gabby Williams to this on and off the ball. Like, that should just be nasty. So I'm right there with you, Steve. Offensively, I'm intrigued. Gabby going to this system in Golden State. Is she, like, the de facto number one option now? Not that it's going to be I run 40 pick and rolls and everyone else gets the scraps. There's just going to be an element of movement within the offense, of course. But this is, I would anticipate, a higher on-ball role than she's ever had. So, like, how does she handle that? How do defenses deal with her in the half-court setting? What does that do with the spacing? And so I'm curious about that part. And then just on the rookie front, like, what does Marta Suarez look like in whatever minutes that we see from her? If Yochite is here, didn't play last year after being a top-five pick, I want to see what those ball screen looks like in this setting if she's available for preseason action. Like, I just want to see her command some of this offense. That's going to be a lot of fun for me. So keeping an eye on the youth, keeping an eye on how Gabby Williams is deployed offensively. And lastly, Steve, going to be in the house for Aces Japan on Sunday. And for me, with the Las Vegas Aces, it's going to be lineup stuff. Who starts? Is Jewel Loyd back in the starting lineup? Do they go low, no blatant starter with like a Kirsten Bell or something and then flow into Jewel Loyd coming in? How often are we going to see Asia at the five versus Asia paired with another big? Dana Evans is still out, so I can just kind of shelve my Dana plus Kennedy Carter questions for a little bit. But when is Kennedy Carter sliding into these games? What are the combinations? Like, how is Becky Hammon going to stagger the stars or the high-level talent here? I am intrigued. And the last thing, based on the episode that we had with Becky Hammon on this very podcast, check that out if you haven't already. One of the things that Becky Hammon snuck in as we were talking about defense was that, hey, I've been watching these NBA games where they just have their big just kind of stay in the corner and keep them low on the floor. I've been, you know, swirling that around in my head a little bit. Are we going to see Asia Wilson deployed like Victor Wembanyama or Chet Holmgren, where it's just a one-person zone, we keep you low on the floor? Is that something that the Aces experiment more with now this year? Becky already hinted at it, so I'm curious to see if we see that attempt. Steve, what are you looking forward to with the Las Vegas Aces in preseason play?
Just the lineups. Who plays with who? Okay. What are you trying to do with different combinations? What's the staggering look like? That's all I want to see. I think defense would probably be number two as far as, you know, not necessarily are you mixing in something completely new, but is there a consistency that you have nailed early on as far as last year you had an attempt, didn't go so great, had to figure it out over the course of the season. So is your defense, do you feel solid about that? What combination are you trying to put together? The Aces are the Aces. We know who they are. So, okay, what kind of tweaks are you trying to make?
Yeah, I think quickly, and then I'll close with this. The Aces bringing in this small training camp roster, I think normally during preseason play, there's only so much you can take from lineup stuff because, you're trying to see who makes the roster, who doesn't. If it's just 13 for the Aces, I feel like them compared to other teams, you'll get a more real picture of what they want their rotation patterns and stuff to be. So I am excited to kind of dig into that and analyze that. So thank you, Steve, for rocking with me. And thank you to anyone that listened to and or watched this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. And if you're a YouTube watcher and you want our W stuff, that's largely going to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel. So subscribe there as well. Awesome content all around, but that's where you'll find our W stuff. You can follow me on socials at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.